Exactly, Van Leer asked. You get 1 liter of soup a day and a ration of bread, then twice a week 1.5 ounces of margarine, a spoonful of jam, and a 1.5 ounce slice of sausage. But don't expect too much. The margarine is only 15% fat, the rest is synthetic thickener, and the sausage is only 50% meat, soggy horse meat. How much nutritional value? How many calories is that altogether?
I've more or less worked it out, Kalker said. The soup's not worth much, about 150 to 200 calories a liter. Altogether, you manage about 1,500 calories a day. Of course, that's not enough. Even at rest, the body needs 1,600. It's clear that someone who has to do hard labor here soon turns into a Muslim.
But if you see those Pfleger, they all look fine, Hans objected.
Sure, but first, they're mostly Poles who get packages from home, and second, they're often the biggest organizers, or, to not mince words, thieves.
The Pfleger dish out the soup. The patients get the liquid on the top. That way, the few potatoes and beans the soup contains are left over for the Pfleger. Just then a tall man came in. He was older, definitely over 60. He had a slight stoop and was wearing an old-fashioned pince-nez on his nose. De Hond leapt up. Good afternoon, Professor. Hans realized that this must be Professor Samuel. He introduced himself and waited to see how the conversation developed. The standard questions, when had they arrived, political news, etc. Hans told him about the transport and their arrival in Auschwitz, placing the emphasis on Friedel. The professor took the bait. In point of fact, I have spoken to several of those new Dutch women. I don't recall the name Van Damme, though. You should try to speak to your wife at the window, but be careful. I'll give her your regards. Hans wanted to ask the professor to deliver a letter for him, but restrained himself. He was counting on the professor for more important favors. Do you visit the women's block often?
Every day. I work there.
Hans feigned ignorance. Are you the attending physician?
Not entirely. I have certain tasks to fulfill.
In a sense, those women are study material. Isn't that unpleasant for them? The professor became defensive.
There are certain experiments that are highly unpleasant, perhaps even deleterious for the women concerned. But what I do is very different. I have managed to interest the SS in research into the development of uterine cancer. I have access to a great number of women for that purpose, and as a result, they are not used for other unpleasant experiments.
Hans gave a nod of understanding. He was more than a little skeptical about the professor's good intentions, but didn't want it to show. He still needed the professor's help.
Decide for yourself, Samuel continued. With my women, I remove a small piece of mucous membrane from the cervix. That sample is then studied under a microscope. Among a certain proportion of the women, we find particular abnormalities in the tissue. We see cells whose structure deviates greatly from the norm. I believe that these cells later give rise to cancer. In this way, I hope to identify the cause of tumor formation.
Judging by the professor's account, the tests were not very harmful to the women. Hans just didn't understand what particular purpose they had. Japanese researchers had already rubbed the skin of white mice with tar products and meticulously tracked the resulting changes to the tissue. Their experiment had resulted in the formation of artificial cancers, establishing that the tar contained carcinogenic substances. At the same time, general medical practice had already shown the medical profession something analogous: lip and tongue cancers in habitual pipe smokers. Once people had thought these cancers were caused by sucking, now they realized that the true cause was the tar products that formed in the stem of the pipe. It seemed to Hans that, whether the tests were useful or not, it was still improper to use people for vivisection against their will. He had to reserve judgment, though, as he didn't have enough facts yet, and, in any case, he had other things on his mind. Will the Dutch women who have just arrived also be subjected to the experiments? Undoubtedly, Samuel replied. But I can help your wife. I'll put her on my list. That way she won't fall into the hands of the others, and I'll be able to keep her out of harm's way for as long as possible. Hans thanked the professor. He was a little relieved. He didn't know what the promise was worth, but he had achieved something. For the time being, Friedel would be spared. It was evening. The lights on the wire had been turned on. The Stubenältester, a fat Pfleger, appeared. He called to the two newcomers, Korpskommando. Der Hund grinned. That's a nice job. Roll up your sleeves for the gunge. They went outside, where there was a large truck with a zinc-covered bed. The corpse carriers were bringing the dead bodies up from the cellar, two per stretcher. They could easily carry two at once because, by the time they died, these emaciated wretches who had been worked into the ground were already skeletons, just skin and bones. The corpse carriers took the bodies one at a time by the arms and legs and tossed them up onto the back of the truck where Hans and Van Leer had to stack them. When the cadavers landed, they slid to the front of the bed under their own momentum, as the zinc was soon slippery from the fluid leaking out of them. Hans and Van Leer had to jump out of the way to try to keep their clothes clean. Once a body had stopped sliding, they picked it up and laid it neatly on the pile, then quickly jumped out of the way again, because the next one would be already sliding toward them. With the corpse carriers doing their best to hit Hans and Van Leer with the bodies, the Dutchmen were constantly dancing back and forth on the back of the truck. It was a gruesome affair. It was now almost dark, and they were lit by the lights on the wire. The cadavers kept sliding over the bed toward the two dancing men, whose hands were now so filthy and slippery they could hardly hold the bodies anymore, and definitely couldn't stop them from rubbing against their clothes. By the time Hans made it back to admissions, he felt unbelievably filthy. There was only cold water to wash his hands in. He didn't have any soap, and no one would lend him any. As far as washing his clothes went, that was completely out of the question. Beautiful slogans about the virtues of cleanliness were painted on the walls of the washroom. Reinlichkeit ist der Weg zur Gesundheit, halte dich sauber, and similar noble sentiments. That was what it was like with the Germans. The slogan had to replace reality. And if you repeated a motto often enough and stuck it on all the walls, everyone would end up believing it. Wir fahren gegen Engeland. Fahr für Victoria. Die Juden sind unser Unglück. The Tibetans have paper wheels with prayers written on them. The wheels turn in the wind, so the prayer is repeated over and over again. If you had been in the washroom and rinsed yourself off with cold water, you just had to read Halte dich sauber 3 times and everything was healthy again. Hans would have rather been amongst the Tibetans. As far as civilization went, the only lead the Germans had on them was in their murder techniques. When he got back to admissions, de Hond was looking for him. Come on, Van Damme. It's almost dark. We're going to block 10. They went out into Birkenallee. There were quite a lot of people there, strolling aimlessly to and fro. A few men were standing near block 10. De Hond led Hans over and introduced him to one of them, Adriaans, a fellow doctor. Adriaans couldn't stop asking questions about Westerbork and his parents-in-law, but Hans found it almost impossible to pay attention. He couldn't take his eyes off the barred windows 10 yards away, where female faces kept appearing every now and then. Adriance continued. He had been here for a couple of months already. He had been so lucky. His wife Ima was in this block. She was working as a nurse, and he was at the Hygienic Institute. To be precise, the Hygienisch-Bakteriologischen Untersuchungsstelle der Waffen-SS und Polizei Südost. That was where the laboratory research for all the camps in the whole area was carried out. It was fairly normal work. The SS lab assistants rushed you, but... And then, without turning, he said, "Hello, Ima. Hello, darling. How was it today?" A young woman had appeared at the window closest to Birkenallee. She was wearing a white shirt and had a red scarf around her head. She gave a scarcely audible reply. Then Hans couldn't take it anymore. He called out to Ima, asking if she would look for Friedel. But the lads gave him a thump and made it clear that he had to be quiet. The corner of the camp was 55 yards away at most. There, on the other side of the first fence, the sentry was at his post on his watchtower. One loud word called out to a woman, a shot, and the idyll would be over forever. Waiting had never been Hans's greatest talent, but now it was as if he had been waiting for years and could no longer bear the tension. The atmosphere was loaded. It was twilight, and women appeared at the window like silhouettes in a shadow theater. It was a sultry late afternoon evening, and the air was full of mystery. As if in a tale from 1001 Nights, the young men stood here outside this enormous harem, full of longing for the women who were rightfully theirs. And then her voice came, like a song from a distant minaret reaching him through a quiet oriental night, a dream of longing and wistfulness, as gentle as the whispering of hidden lovers, and as sad as the song of the imam calling to the prophet with his body bent low to the ground.
"Hans, sweetheart, thank God you're here too.
Friedel, now we're together, it makes all the difference." He tried to pick her out, but the growing darkness had made the women braver, and they were now crowded up to the windows, all looking alike in their red headscarves. He told her so. "I'll take my scarf off so you can see how beautiful I am now." There at the second window, that was her, his girl. He smiled. Of course she was beautiful. He would always find her equally beautiful, whether she had hair or whether her head was shaven. And if he could possess her again, she would be the same for him, no matter how violated. "What's it like in your block?" The lads had taken position in front of Hans, so the sentry couldn't see him, and now he could speak a little more freely.
"Oh, it's not bad here. You don't have to work, and it's clean. Friedel, I've spoken to the professor. You needn't be afraid. He says that, as a doctor's wife, he'll spare you."
"Good. Apparently some awful things go on here."
Hans saw the woman next to Friedel nudge her. Clearly that was something you weren't allowed to talk about.
"Friedel, dear, I'm in the hospital. I'll be able to stick it out there."
Then it was over. He heard a whistle, and the lads gave Hans a push. They were walking along Birkenallee and no longer paying attention to the women's block. A young man came up to them.
"It was me who whistled. Clausen's in the camp."
Clausen was the Rapportführer. He came into the camp at odd times so he could report back to the Lagerführer in the evenings about what was happening. He was a real German, tall and blonde, who looked like he'd just stepped out of a picture. In the mornings, he was mean, but in the evenings, he was dangerous, because in the evenings, he was usually drunk. The urge to cruelty, which is systematically suppressed in every civilized person by their environment and education from early childhood, had been stirred in the German nation. National Socialist morality
plus the required dose of alcohol, turned men into devils. Although that is actually an insult to the devil, because he is a just avenger. The devil only torments those who have earned their punishment, or when he, as with Faust, is justified by a contract and terms of sale. Nazis throw themselves on defenseless victims with no justification at all. That was what happened that night with Clausen, the Rapportführer. The lads observed him from a safe distance. Everyone who came near him was in for it, a kick or a blow, and those who didn't make off in time were beaten to the ground and received a terrible introduction to Clausen's boots. But up came Willi, the Lager-Eltester, the senior representative of the Häftlinge. Smiling, he approached Clausen, cap in hand. The object of fear hesitated a moment, but when he saw Willi's open expression and friendly nods, he calmed down. He gave the Lager-Eltester a jovial pat on the shoulder and went off with him, probably to have a drink together. The camp could breathe again. Willi had saved the day. Willi was a decent chap. He felt duty-bound to take the side of the Häftlinge and wasn't scared of running risks to do so. He was a German, but as a communist, he'd already spent 8 years in the KZ. Dering, however, was different. Dering was the Lager-Eltester for the Krankenbau. Like all the Elteste, he had been chosen from among the prisoners by the SS. Hans first met him the next morning. "What kind of doctor are you?" Hans told him in just a few words. He felt an aversion to this man, who leaned back in his chair with such indifference and addressed a fellow doctor as if he were a naughty boy. "Enough. Wait in the corridor." Several Häftlinge were already waiting there. Most of them were young Poles, who were going to be presented to Dering as potential Pfleger. In addition, 3 Jews, Hans, the junior doctor von Leer, and an elderly man who introduced himself as Dr. Benjamin, a pediatrician from Berlin. He was from the same transport as Hans, but after disinfection, Professor Samuel had taken him straight to the hospital. He knew the professor from their student days. After Dering had seen the last of the young Poles, a clerk came with a list. He put the Jewish doctors to one side and took away the Poles. After a few minutes, he came back. "You have to go into quarantine first," he told them. "Then you can be placed in the Krankenbau." When Hans had come back from seeing the Lagerarzt the previous day, he'd thought he'd achieved his goal. But de Hond had warned him, "You've got past the German, but you've still got to get past the Pole." Unfortunately, de Hond had been right. The Lagerarzt had taken him on, but the Polish head of the hospital had now fobbed him off with quarantine. Would he make it back into the hospital? Or was this just a ploy on the part of the Lager-Eltester? The possibility terrified Hans. Why weren't the young Poles going into quarantine with them? Why just the 3 Jews? In quarantine, Hans got to know Lager life. He had to share the top berth of a triple bunk with 2 others, the elderly Dr. Benjamin and a Russian. In the morning, at 4:30, the big gong on the roof of the kitchen was rung, and within 10 seconds, an enormous racket had been unleashed. Everyone was awake and climbing down the bunks, and then the Stubeneltester were climbing up to make sure nobody was still snoozing. If they were, they would be beaten out of bed. They joined the long line waiting in the central corridor for a turn to wash. That hour spent waiting was a harsh ordeal for Hans. After waking up, he always had to go straight to the toilet. He had been like that his whole life. And now, he had to stand in line wearing just an undershirt and with no opportunity to slip off for a minute. If you tried to seek sympathy from the Stubeneltester or the guard at the door, you would only get a few slaps for your trouble. That hour, too, came to an end.
Then you were given a pair of wooden sandals at the door and went downstairs. That was where the latrines and the washroom were.
At the latrines, the Scheißmeister, keeping a close watch to make sure nobody made a mess. He had a stick in his hand and knew how to use it. In the washroom, the Bademeister, again with a stick. Slogans on the walls. Sauberkeit ist der halbe Weg zur Gesundheit, and similarly beautiful statements. Cleanliness might be halfway to health, but try getting clean when you only have a few drops of cold water, no soap, and have to dry yourself with your undershirt. After washing, there was an inspection, and woe betide those who weren't clean. Then making the beds. Wherever they were, the Germans had a thing about these beds. In the first place, they were not meant to be slept in, but looked at. And if the blankets were dirty or the straw mattress empty, or if a diseased person or a dead body had been lying in the bed, it didn't matter, as long as it was well made without a crease in the blanket or a loose straw on top of it. And then queuing up again for a mouthful of coffee, in that interminable line behind the bunks with 200 Poles and Russians. Whether you were thirsty or not, you had to line up. There were far too few bowls, so two of you drank out of one bowl, and you had to be quick about it because others were already waiting for that bowl. Halte dich sauber was written on the walls, and they all drank out of the same bowl. Keep clean while slurping your coffee out of it and eating your soup out of it with a piece of wood as a spoon. Hans couldn't help but think of the story about a parson visiting a farmer, one of his parishioners, and sitting at the table to eat groats out of a common pot. When he gets a lump in his mouth, the farmer notices and says, "Spit it back in, parson. I just had it too." What kind of things had been spat back into the bowls here? Hans still had a humorous take on it all, but not Dr. Benjamin. The old man was broken. He couldn't bear being hit and harried all day long, and at the same time, his helplessness meant he received more slaps than anyone. When they finally had their coffee, he, of course, couldn't drink it fast enough. He paid for it with a slap. After the coffee, the order, all on the beds. It cost Dr. Benjamin a kick. After that, they spent a couple of hours sitting on the beds, while more privileged prisoners, the room orderlies, mopped the floor. Privileged because they had earned an extra ladle of soup for it. Hans was bored. He just happened to be a very active person. But he thought of something Lane Saunders had said. Every day you're in quarantine is a bonus. Just as much to eat as in the work commandos, but no work. You conserved energy, sure, but it turned you into a nervous wreck, waiting for coffee, waiting for soup, waiting for blows and snarls. Outside now, and then in the daytime. It was good to be between the blocks. But the September sun turned the place into an oven in the afternoons. There was one good thing about going outside. Hans was in a room full of Poles and Russians he couldn't exchange a single word with. Dr. Benjamin and he were the only Jews, and their fellow prisoners were hostile toward them. But outside, you met people from the other quarantine rooms. There were Czechs and Austrians. And the most beautiful thing was that you could always find someone who was prepared to explain to you that the war could only last another 3 months at most. And then, after 3 days, the great feast. A package from Friedel with a couple of slices of bread with jam and margarine. In quarantine, they just broke the bread into pieces. This bread had been sliced neatly and made into a sandwich prepared by a woman's hand, his wife's. She was so close, 1,000 feet at most, but there were guards on the doors, and if they caught him, it would mean a real thrashing. It was a chance you could take, but it could also lead to a report to the SS, and that would mean a punishment detail, which was something he couldn't risk. And so he lived with the tension of inactivity, waiting, bread and blows, boredom and longing. After a week, things changed. It was hot between the blocks, very hot. A sliver of shade was hugging the side of block 13 and only expanding slowly, because time passed slowly on that endless, scorching, sunny day. Crowded into that sliver was half of Central and Eastern Europe. The other half couldn't fit into the shade and was squatting against the sunlit wall of block 12, or lying stretched out in the dust, pointing every which way. Sleeping with their hats on their faces, naked torsos filthy from a grimy mix of sweat and sand. Hans preferred the heat of the sun to the body heat of the men crammed into the shade. He was strolling along with Oppenheim, who was giving an exposition on his favorite theme, the end of the war in relation to the petroleum shortage. Then a loud voice. "Everyone with wooden shoes, fall in!" Hans hesitated. He was one of the few with shoes. All of the others had gone straight to quarantine from disinfection. They were still wearing sandals. His hesitation proved disastrous because the Blockältester, who had yelled the order, was right there. He dragged Hans along, spewing out curses because he had seen him trying to slink off. Altogether, there were 15 men, mostly Poles, coarse, sturdy young fellows, still well-fed from home. They marched in twos to block one, where there were wagons. They were given straps that were wired to one of the wagons and had to use them to haul the wagon to the gate. The Blockältester, who was supervising them, announced, "Häftling 27903 mit 15 Häftlingen zum Straßenbau." So that was it. Roadworks. The SS man noted the commando down in a book that lay on the counter of the Blockführerstube. Then they continued on their way. Hans smiled when he thought of the day of his arrival, a week ago now. All that human machinery pulling wagons. Now he was pulling one himself, a small cog in one of those 15-cog machines. And if he didn't pull hard enough for a moment, he would immediately get a kick from the Pole behind him. "Dale, dale," cried the Poles. "Davai, bystra," the Russians. "Los, Schweinehunde," the Blockältester. And if an SS man happened to be passing, he shouted it twice as hard and hit whoever was closest with his stick, on the back or on the head, it didn't matter where, as long as he demonstrated what an enthusiastic Blockältester he was. It was like that everywhere with the Nazis. The SS yelled at everyone, including the Blockältester. The Blockältester yelled and lashed out, at the Poles too, and they in turn chose the weakest to yell at. The weakest were Hans and a Polish Jew called Leib. They didn't say anything in reply. Hans could feel that the Poles were shouting to release the tension from being shouted at themselves. The Führer shouted at his generals. They could bear it because they in turn got to shout at their officers, and the officers shouted at the soldiers. Like a billiard ball that stops rolling when it hits another ball, the soldiers calmed down again after beating the prisoners and shouting at them. The Blockältester hit the Poles, and the Poles hit Hans. The Führer's blow had reached Hans, where it couldn't do any more harm, because Hans was powerless. He was also powerless when they arrived at the pile of gravel. They were meant to load the gravel in two gangs, but he was always the dupe, because when it was time for the gang to be relieved, there was never anyone to take his shovel. It made sense. 15 equals 7 plus 8. 8 of them worked, and 7 were there to relieve them, so the 8th didn't have anyone to relieve him, and the 8th was always Hans. He complained to Leib, who said something to the others in Polish. They laughed, but nothing happened. They dragged the wagon back and forth many times, picking up gravel outside and carting it back to the camp, where others from quarantine were already at work spreading it on the streets. Hans was wet through. His hands were blistered from the shovel, and his feet were chafed where the edges of the wooden shoes scraped over his bare skin. After being pushed to the front so many times by the Poles, he went over to the SS guard next to the pile of gravel. But he didn't get a chance to complain. The mighty Sturmmann did not wish to be disturbed. Hans took the slap in the face with gritted teeth, and the work carried on as before, with shoves from the Blockältester and mocking from the Poles. When they entered the camp after the sixth trip with the fully loaded wagon, all of the other commandos had already returned. The prisoners were already in roll call formation in front of the blocks. From all sides, people were yelling at them to hurry and raising their fists in menace, so they dragged the wagon half running, with every SS man they passed still managing to land a few telling blows. Panting, they reached the quarantine block, left the wagon, and ran upstairs. In the corridors, the others had long since lined up for roll call. Curses were coming at them from all directions, and the room orderlies were hitting them, as if it was their fault they'd been forced to work so long. The roll call was very slow. The SS man had long since come and gone, and they were still standing there waiting. Hans felt dizzy. His heart wouldn't stop racing. His throat stayed choked shut, and his grazed feet were burning so badly he had tears in his eyes. And if he squatted for a moment, or tried to lean on the bunks behind him, there was always a comrade to immediately give him a poke so that he jumped back to attention. After roll call, fetching bread, which again meant seemingly endless lining up. Then the bread and the coffee. A little bit of jam smeared on the bread. He licked it off. He drank the coffee but couldn't get the bread down his throat. Later, after he'd been able to lie down for a while, his appetite would come back then. He undressed in preparation and lay down on the bed. Sleep came over him as salvation, liberation from the strap that had bound him to the wagon. The shovel had been taken out of his hands at last. All pain was stilled and longing hushed because he had sunk deep into the dark pool of unconsciousness. Suddenly a yell, a shock.
Alles aufstehen!
What was happening? Pure confusion as thoughts formed again from the fathomless depths. Was that mother calling? Was there a fire? Was he ill, running a fever? He could hardly move. Then his mind cleared. The Russian he shared his bed with was giving him a good shaking.
Foot inspection!
What? Now? Exhausted and miserable, he had been overwhelmed by sleep and hadn't washed. Now it was the middle of the night and his feet were dirty. But this time he was in luck. The SS man was drunk and couldn't see straight. He walked past Hans, who was allowed to lie down again half an hour later, and went back to sleep immediately. He wasn't rested at 4 o'clock that morning. All of his muscles, the skin over his whole body, pain everywhere. He hoped he wouldn't be put to work again, but it was a vain hope. No sooner were they lined up than the room orderly came in with a note. He had the details' numbers, and Hans had to go out again. Now it would be a whole day. 11 hours of loading gravel, carting gravel, unloading gravel. Sometimes with a little variation, spreading the gravel over a new section of street or sieving the old road surfacing, then pulling the wagon again. Hans held up under it. He kept working even though his back seemed about to burst open, even though the shovel in his hands seemed to be made of glowing lead. It was the only correct attitude, because when the Poles saw that he wasn't giving up, they gradually became a little more accommodating, and now and then, one of them even took his shovel from him. But that was hardly an advantage, those few minutes of rest, because when he had to start again, He was so stiff that every movement used up 2 or 3 times as much energy. Still, he got through that day too, and the next day, and the fourth, and the days passed without too many incidents. A blow, a snarl, cursing, but who counts any of that? Or the exhaustion and pain only increasing, what did they matter? The grazes on his feet started to fester. The sanitäter put some sepso on it, an iodine surrogate, but what would that help? His eyes were inflamed from the sun and the sand, but so what? The one time he did report to sick parade in the morning, the sanitäter laughed at him. For a few miserable little scrapes like that. And then the hunger. Constant hunger. What, after all, is a single ration of bread and a liter of soup a day? And what kind of soup? Water with some beets in it, or chopped turnips. Now and then, 1.5 potatoes per liter of soup, and they were always at the bottom of the kettle, which the room orderlies reserved for themselves and their friends. Sometimes you could get your hands on another liter through a friend or good fortune, but it was better not to eat it. It was definitely better not to eat too much soup, because now, after 1 or 2 weeks, all of the old prisoners, in a camp that means between 40 and 45, had edema of the legs. What would become of him if he got edema with these wounds? They would never heal. On the 5th day, as they were dragging the fully loaded wagon, the incident. There on the left, women coming down a side street. They were ordered to stop the wagon 50 yards from the intersection to make sure none of the men came into contact with the women. Hans held his breath, peering intently. Then, losing all self-control, a cry, "Friedel!" He threw off his strap and ran toward the women. But he had only gone a step or two when someone grabbed him. It was Leib, the Polish Jew, who brought him back to his senses.
"You idiot! They'll beat you till you can't even stand up anymore!"
Hans said he didn't care.
"They'll beat her, too."
That convinced him. Nervously, he looked at the Blockältester, who was supervising the work but hadn't noticed anything. He had walked ahead a little to watch the girls. Still, Friedel had seen him and waved from the distance, cautiously, with a slight movement of one hand. It seemed to him that she was trying to say, "I'm still here. Do you think of me sometimes?" And he answered, "Oh, I am so tired, too tired to think of you."
"But you have to think of me, because that's the only way you'll be able to stick it out."
That was true, and he waved back cautiously, as if to signal that he'd understood, that she was right, and that he would keep on fighting with her image before him. Even harder days came. The weather changed, turning colder. At first it was a relief. His skin didn't smart as much, his muscles felt a little more supple, and he didn't get out of breath as quickly as in the heat. But then the rain came. His clothes offered no protection. A linen coat and an undershirt. He was soaked to the skin. But that wasn't the worst. After 2 days of rain, there was nothing left of the road. The entire route to the pile of gravel was a succession of ponds and mounds of muddy clay. The water was over their ankles. Their shoes got sucked down into the mud, and the wheels sank in gunge up to the axles. But they had to keep the wagon moving. And if it got stuck in the mud with its load of gravel, the Blockältester's stick knew what to do. And if the Blockältester wasn't able to rage hard enough to get the wagon loose, an SS man who was better at it would come along. He'd wade through the muck in his boots and give the closest man a kick that sent mud flying around everyone's ears. Then they'd grab the spokes of the wheels and tug and twist, and the Sturmmann would bellow and lash out, and the Block-L-Tester would laugh to show how much he admired the Sturmmann's energetic approach. And so they got the wagon moving again after all. Because although the men were wet and tired, 1 or 2 weeks hadn't been enough to fully deplete their energy reserves, and when they had to, they could. They all had scrapes and lumps from the blows they'd received, but so far none of them had been really hurt. But they knew that wasn't something you could rely on. Just yesterday, they had seen the Blockführer, the SS man in charge of the blocks, hit a gypsy boy so hard his whole cheek burst open. He hadn't been standing straight enough. After the roll call, they'd had to take him to the Krankenbau. You heard about people being beaten and wounded almost every day. That was why Hans and the other men put in even more effort. Faced with the furious SS man and with everyone in equal danger, a sense of solidarity arose after all. The Poles encouraged Hans, and Hans did his best to help the Poles. They no longer felt the pain from the blows, only grim determination. They would get the wagon out.
Hau ruck! Hau ruck!
15 pairs of arms succeeded where 2 horses would have certainly failed. But at this stage, they were still strong. They still had energy reserves. What would it be like in a week? In a month? Hans worried in bed at night. He felt ill. He had taken off the wet undershirt, but a fever made him shiver under the one small blanket he had to share with 2 others. Despite the warmth, despite the many people crammed in together, he was shivering. What would he be like tomorrow? The Poles, who had already been there for several weeks, often received packages from home. The Russians often got food from friends in the camp. Nobody was as skilled at organizing as a Russian. Even if 10 SS men were standing near the kitchen, a Russian wasn't scared and always managed to filch a bag of potatoes. And he always managed to make a concealed fire to cook them. But nowhere was there as much comradeship as among the Russians either, because that same Russian always had a friend in quarantine to share his booty with. But who looked after Hans, or the handful of other Dutchmen in quarantine? He had already noticed that the Dutch weren't held in high regard in the camp. Whether Jews or non-Jews, the Dutch were seen as weak and lazy. Maybe they were right. The Dutch are calm and businesslike. They're not used to being overzealous, using underhand practices to pursue their goals, or letting themselves be rushed along. And why should they be zealous about this drudgery? It was either pointless, in which case zeal was insane, or it was a war industry, and then laziness was an obligation. But as a result, almost none of the Dutch prisoners had a position where they could organize anything. Not one worked in the kitchen block or the storerooms, and, with the possible exception of Lane Saunders, the few who had anything showed precious little community spirit. Friedel did manage to smuggle in a few more packages of bread for him. Again, they felt like a blessing beyond any he'd ever received before. But how could that help with this hunger, with this work? How much longer could he last? After 3 weeks, the surprise. It was still very early, and Hans was nibbling the small slice of bread he had saved from yesterday for the 3rd time, when the block clerk came into the room. He called out numbers, including Hans's. 4 of them stood together in the corridor, and after the commandos had left, they went to the Krankenbau. There was already a whole group of prospective Pfleger in Block 21. Hans got into a conversation with a little old man. At first sight, he looked fat, but on closer inspection, you saw how swollen he was. The fat was all water. On his forehead, he had a large boil. His name was Kohn. He was a dermatologist and had been working in a roadworks commando for a month already. This was the third time he had had to come to see the Lagerarzt, and he was sure that he would be turned away again this time, too. Hans was feeling more optimistic, and his instincts were correct. A few short questions about his training and so on, and then he felt that it was going to be all right. Back to the Krankenbau after all. Another chance after all. The wagon, the gravel, being overworked, spending entire days in the rain, all that was over. And despite his rough hands, he couldn't even write a note anymore. Despite the wounds on his feet, despite his back, which he could neither bend nor stretch, he returned to Block 28 and the admissions ward, full of courage and fighting spirit. Can you imagine that you can also get bored in a concentration camp? Hans was bored. There was no work for them in Block 28. They had to wait until they were assigned to the different hospital blocks where Pfleger were required. Hans wouldn't have minded getting some rest, lying on his bed until late in the morning, going out into the autumn sun in the afternoon, but that wasn't possible either. After all, the principle of a concentration camp was Bewegung. Even if there wasn't anything to do, you had to keep moving at all times. Getting up in the morning to the sound of the gong, washing and dressing, and then, when the work gong rang 3/4 of an hour later, starting work. The room orderlies mopped the floor. You weren't allowed to help, because then the room orderlies wouldn't have any work left and would get put into who knows what kind of heavy outside commando. Then cleaning windows again. Armed with a piece of newspaper or some other kind of scrap paper, you began at 6 in the morning. At noon, when the soup arrived, you had cleaned 2 windows. If you did it too quickly, you had to make them dirty again and start over. Woe betide you if the Block Eltester or an SS man came near and you weren't industriously cleaning. A snarl and a blow was the least you could expect. But they could also tell you that they had no use for a lazy Pfleger and that you had to go and stand next to the bell the next morning. That meant falling in outside the blocks the next morning at the second gong. You had to go and stand under the gong to be assigned to a different commando. That was why they cleaned their windows industriously. Hans was still very content. The work was boring and spending the whole day on your feet was tiring, but it didn't sap your strength. The soup in the Krankenbau was often a little better than in quarantine, and it was mostly possible to get 0.5 liter extra because a lot of the Polish Pfleger, who received enormous packages, didn't eat the Lagerzuppe at all. In general, roll call in the camp dragged on forever. Sometimes the men had to stand in the rain for 2 or more hours. The Krankenbau did its own count, however, which was always completed in a few minutes. Then, after roll call, you could go to sleep, or walk, or do something else as you wished. There were no foot inspections or similar harassments. Pfleger are presumed to be able to keep themselves clean enough. It was possible to live. And most importantly for him, he was in touch with Friedel again. The evenings were growing shorter, and in the twilight, he could generally find someone who was willing to go with him as a lookout so that he could talk to her at the window for a few minutes. Friedel, I don't need any more food from you. I'm getting extra soup every day now. What good is that soup going to do you? Today I earned a ration of bread. I washed some underwear for a fat Pole. Friedel ran a nervous hand over her centimeter-long hair. They were silent. Yelling came from the room behind Friedel. A little later, the block clerk was on to us, but she didn't see that it was me who was talking. How are things there? Oh, Hans, we don't have to work. We get extra rations just like the people doing hard labor. That makes it doable, but... But what? He insisted. Oh, it's all so sinister here. Now with those Greek girls again,
What exactly it is, I don't know. They've been burnt internally. There were 15 of them. After the treatment, they were in terrible pain. One has died. Are you sure they're not going to do something like that to you, too? Those experiments seem to be over. Last week, there was someone called Professor Schumann, a fat Jerry, but I don't see him anymore now. I think they've started on something else, something with injections down below. Won't they take you for that, then? Maybe not. I'm a nurse now on the ward with all the Dutch women, and they don't tend to take the staff as quickly. Then they had to stop again, because that familiar high-pitched whistle was sounding through the camp. Every evening, the Rapportführer entered the camp. He was a dangerous fellow, Oberscharführer Clausen. He always carried a riding crop. If you got close to him and only received a lash with the whip, you were getting off lightly. When he entered the camp, a shrill, high-pitched whistle from the Häftlinge sounded as a warning. Everyone who heard it passed it on, and no matter how much it annoyed Clausen, he never managed to catch any of the whistlers in the act. But he still vented his rage, taking it out on anyone he could pick fault with. If your hair was too long, if you hadn't stood to attention rigidly enough, if you smiled, or if he simply didn't like the look of you. Not an evening passed without at least one man getting a severe beating, and even that was a moderate state of affairs compared to places like Buna or Birkenau, the so-called Auschwitz II. This place, Auschwitz I, was the model camp. The blocks were brick and there were beds for everyone. This was where the big storehouses were, where a little extra for everyone could be filched now and then, and where the model hospital was. No, the conditions in Auschwitz I were not indicative of the Auschwitz complex in general, not according to the fellow Hans spoke to that evening. He had arrived with Hans last month and had been sent to Buna in the group of 228 men. It was 2 hours by foot. An enormous industrial complex with building sites everywhere. Most of the lads had to lay cables. Some of them were in the concrete commando. It wasn't easy, lugging 165-pound bags of cement all day and at the double. Hans should try to imagine how they felt in the evenings. They had to carry the bags a distance of more than 100 yards from the narrow-gauge railway to the concrete mixers, and every 10 yards there was a capo or an SS man swinging his fists to keep the pace up. There was a fatality right away on the very first day. Did Hans remember Plaut, the registered nurse from Vesterbork, a very capable fellow? They played the old trick on him. There were guards posted at the four corners of the grounds they were working on. You weren't allowed to cross those lines. The SS man ordered Plaut to fetch a small box that was outside of those bounds. When Plaut hesitated, he hit him on the head with a shovel. He had no choice but to go and get the box, but as soon as he crossed the line between the guard posts, they shot him. Don't say a word to his wife. She's here in Block 10. The next day it was old Jacobson, a 45-year-old. In camp terms, that's ancient. He was jogging along in the hot, suffocating afternoon and collapsed under his 165 pounds. Anyone who tried to help him was driven away with blows with a stick. After half an hour, they let someone look at him. He was dead. We wanted to carry away the body, but that wasn't allowed because he'd been counted when we'd turned out in the morning, and the number had to be right in the evening as well. So we dragged the body with us to the evening roll call so it could be counted again. Now, after 5 weeks, 20 of our lads are already dead, and that will go faster and faster because everyone is exhausted and we all have wounds. Just yesterday, Joop van Dyk, built like this, but lugging the bag of cement, he had to stop for a moment to catch his breath. The guard saw him, hit him with his rifle butt, then kicked him in the head when he was on the ground. Joop just lay there unconscious. He must have landed badly,
because when we went to take him back with us in the evening, he still hadn't regained consciousness. There was blood coming out of his ear. Nobody could help him. First, we had to line up for roll call. During roll call, he came round a little, groaning and asking for water. He kept it up for about 2 hours. Then, finally, at the end of the roll call, they took him to hospital. This morning, he was dead. How did you get here? Hans asked. Yesterday evening, I reported to the hospital. I had a temperature and a sore throat. They said I had diphtheria, and people with contagious diseases aren't allowed to stay there. That's why I've been brought here to the central hospital. I'm glad of it, too. That infirmary in Buna is a terrible place. The beds are triple bunks like here, but they put the worst cases on top, supposedly to give them more air. Last night there was a dysentery patient with severe diarrhea above me. He spent the whole night yelling for a bedpan. There was nobody to help him, of course, so he kept doing it in bed. Toward morning, it started to leak through. I crawled over to one side as far as I could to avoid getting it all over me. When the Pfleger came and saw what had happened, he started hitting the fellow, right in the face, at least 5 times. The Pfleger is fat. He dishes out the soup and serves himself from the bottom of the kettle. If someone dies, and that's a couple of people every day, there's bread left over. If someone gets moved to a different ward or hospital, they don't send the bread on. That Pfleger in Buna is eating my ration of bread for tonight, right now. Anyway, my throat's too sore to swallow it.
So you're lucky to have diphtheria?
I'm not so sure. I reckon everyone who ends up in Auschwitz hospital goes from here to the gas chamber. No, Hans didn't believe that. The Lagerarzt did come in from time to time, but they didn't take strong young men away with them. Can you get a message to my wife? The man asked. Did you have children? No. Then she'll be in Block 10, like all the women from our transport. It's too dangerous in the daytime, but I can try tomorrow evening. What's your name again? Have you forgotten? Buchbinder, the Zionist leader. Hans remembered now, and they talked about Zionism and subjects like that for a while. Even if you're up to your neck in filth, you don't want to completely degenerate. Hans was no Zionist. There is no special Jewish issue, just general social issues, general social contradictions that are taken out on Jews. If those problems were thrashed out once and for all, the Jewish question would automatically cease to exist. But the Jews who cling to their own religion and traditions will always remain a foreign element. Even if that's the case, what does it matter? In Russia, dozens of ethnic groups with their own cultures, small and large, live alongside each other without conflict. But their hearts weren't in the conversation, and Hans was glad when the gong rang. 9 o'clock, time to go to sleep. In admissions, the diphtheria patients' bunks were next to those of the Reservepflege. That was no cause of concern. After all, they were all going to end the same way, unless the Allies suddenly appeared. Who would still be alive? Ah, it was all taking so long, too long for them. And there was that ball of clay again, the one that lodged in his thoughts and, like a golem, sometimes became a separate entity, holding long discourses on life and death. But Hans now knew the magic word that broke the golem's spell, Friedel. Because she existed, the golem was silenced. Hans summoned up her image, and the ball of clay shrank and became lifeless again. He grew calmer. Where there had been fear and doubt, he now felt a quiet longing, and with that, he fell asleep. He had been in Block 28 for a fortnight when instructions came one afternoon.
All Reservepfleger fall in!
What was it this time?
The Blockältester came into admissions with a well-dressed häftling, a real prominent. The man was wearing a black jacket and a black beret. His striped trousers were of a woolly material, the full prominent style. They talked a little between themselves, and the stranger said that he could use 5 of them.
Take 6, the Blockältester said. Otherwise, I'll never get rid of them.
They picked out 6 of the lads, including 4 Dutchmen. Hans, the young psychologist Gerhard van Wyk, Tony Hochstein, who had a bachelor's in medicine, and Van Leer, the junior doctor. They had to gather up their things and go with the man, who turned out to be the new Blockältester of Block 9. He was friendly and told them that he had already spent 9 years in concentration camps. As a communist, he had been picked up in the first year of Hitler's regime. He was now 50.
Oh, camp life's bearable once you've got a bit used to it. You know, 90% die in the first year, but if you get through that, you can manage the rest too. You get used to the food, you get clothes that are a little better, and once you're an Alterhäftling, the SS has a bit of respect for you.
But don't you want to get out again? Hans asked.
Wanting it's one thing. It's not so much fun on the outside either. I'm a carpenter. Am I supposed to start all over again with a boss at my age? In the camp, I'm my own boss.
I thought the SS was the boss.
Oh, they're all little brats. I was already in Oranienburg when they were still in nappies.
The camp isn't a camp anymore. It's a sanatorium. You're Dutch, aren't you? I've had dealings with Dutchmen before. That was, let me see, in 1941 in Buchenwald. 400 Dutch Jews. I was Blockältester in the quarantine block. They were with me for 3 months and had already got a bit used to it. I made sure they didn't have to work too hard. After all, they were better lads than the Poles and their sort. Then the whole troop was suddenly sent to Mauthausen. I heard later that they ended up in a gravel pit, carting gravel up the slope at double time the whole day long. The toughest ones stuck it out for 5 weeks. He was right. Hans remembered the story from Amsterdam. In February, Hendrik Koot, a member of the WA, was beaten to death in the Jewish quarter. In retaliation, the Groene Polizei rounded up 400 young men off the streets. A couple of months later, the first death notices came. The others didn't last much longer. Meanwhile, they had arrived at Block 9. They had to wait in the corridor for a while and were then shown into Room 1. Sitting on the other side of the table was a short, thick-set man wearing a red triangle with a P on it. A Polish political prisoner, in other words. He had a round, fat head and a hard mouth, but a gentle, somewhat distracted look in his eyes. Nervously, he fidgeted with a pencil. He was sure to have been through a lot and might have been in the camp a long time, too. The lads had to report to him one by one. As the acting Blockältester and senior doctor in the block, he would be allocating the jobs. First up was Tony Hochstein. Was he a doctor? He tried to evade the question a little. Then the block doctor asked him how old he was. 22. The bystanders laughed, and there were mumbled comments along the lines of Blöde Holländer. Then it was the turn of Gerhard van Wyk, who said that he had studied medicine and was now a psychologist. The block doctor didn't entirely understand, so he was a psychiatrist? Gerhard didn't dare say no.
Go to Room 3, then, to your compatriot Polak. They couldn't use him in Buna. That's where the madmen are.
Hans felt like the ground had been cut from under his feet. After all, he had been a psychiatric intern for 2 years and was a lot closer to being a psychiatrist than Gerhard, the theoretician. But trying to compete didn't seem sensible, Maybe Gerard's only chance was as a psychiatrist. Accordingly, Hans called himself an internist. Fine, the boss said. Just stay here in this room. This is the admissions doctor, Ochodsky. You can assist him a bit.
Von Leer didn't get a hearing. The Block L tester from 28 had already told his new colleague at 9 that Von Leer had a foot wound. As a result, he had to go to a hospital ward first until the wound had healed.
Hans was delighted. Assisting the admissions doctor, that had to be a good job. He still hadn't grasped anything about how things worked. Who practiced medicine in the lager? The lads of 18 and